I took a walk with Zeus the Wonder Dog. I've been walking a lot lately to clear my head during the coronavirus panic, with everything so bleak and the barking dogs of politics and journalism and political advantage and the dead. And so as I went walking, it was cool and wet again, and there was no sun in the sky again. But it was perfect for listening to music and thinking about a problem I'm trying to work out. What is the iconic image of this coronavirus pandemic that's killing so many and altering our lives? I think I found it, and I'll tell you about it. But first, as I was walking Zeus, and I made sure I brought the plastic bags because, God forbid, you walk a dog and you don't have them. It's worse than smoking a cigar in a park alone. I also wanted to tell you something funny and ridiculous. Something light. Something my good friend, Dr. Michael Burns, podiatrist to the stars, came up with. He's from the South Side. He's a guy who joked with me on the podcast and Jeff once about women chopping off their pinky toes to squeeze into those Jimmy Choo shoes. They're only $800 a pair or $900 a pair. Anyway, so Mike and I were talking on the phone the other day. He loves dogs, and he offered to let Betty, Zeus, and me live in his house. It was kind of him. I don't need the offer. Thank you, Mike. No. But while we were talking, he came up with an idea. Keep your hands off your face during the coronavirus, and maybe we can make a fortune. You ever see a dog cone? Mike and I could make a fortune with that one. Democrats love dogs. Republicans love dogs. And with the coronavirus, they're funding everything, so why not send a few trillions our way, too? You've seen those dog cones on dogs to prevent them from licking or chewing the parts of their bodies that veterinarians don't want them to touch. Now here's the question. Why do dogs scratch their ears with their feet? Because they can. And why do humans touch their faces during coronavirus when they're told not to? Because they can. So if dog cones work for dogs, they'll work for humans. Just fix that big plastic cone to the human head. Just make sure it's longer than your fingertips. And bingo, you can't touch your face. Now, wearing dog cones might be awkward, and it might resemble the inverse of those medieval doctor's masks in the plague. Not that I wanted you to think of the plague. But it might be difficult to walk around or drive or eat. But then you're supposed to stay inside. Stay away from the fridge. Dog cone. I can't wait for Nancy Pelosi to send a few $100 million my way. More important than the Kennedy Center. And she got them the money and they just cut all their employees after they got the money. So I would be, you know, employing people to make dog cones. But we've got other stuff to talk about. Some serious stuff. And food, too. And that's serious. I'm sitting out on the back stoop in the undisclosed location now that we've moved. My friend Jeff Carlin, you can hear the engine in the background and somebody's wind chime. My friend Jeff Carlin, the executive producer of the Rokon Show on WGN, is back again at the WGN studios. He's putting it together, mixing sound, ready with his thoughts. And my good friend and Michelin chef, Carrie Nahabedian of Chicago, her two restaurants are Brondeal and Costali. They're great, and you've got to go once the restaurants are open again. Anyway, Carrie's in Florida. She sent me a photo of a hammock in the sun. Thanks, Carrie. I don't have a hammock and there's no sun. But she'll visit with us on Mr. Peabody's Wayback Machine, talk about food and her career. And I love her, that story. The backstory of Carrie Nahabedian is just perfect. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and member of that great newspaper's editorial board. You know where you are? With the icons of coronavirus to be determined, and politicos using the virus to leverage their power. As you hit the fridge, and you don't want to hit the fridge, and you wish you had a dog cone on your head, so you wouldn't eat so much. Where are you? You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
So like I was saying, Zeus and I walked for a couple miles in the rain. I walk him. I think about a column. I think about column ideas. I think about talking to you on the podcast. We stopped at the edge of a park. It was good to see all that green open space and listen. And as I was listening, I thought of icons. The nature of an icon, the nature of this coronavirus pandemic as we're hunkering down. And listening to that ancient holy music had me think of icons in church and the meaning of icons. We don't pray to them as graven images, but we do venerate them and use them to focus our prayers. And I thought about the way we use icon today, or the way many of us use it today. Not a holy image crafted thousands of years ago, but of a cartoon on your phone or your laptop to drive an app. Webster's Dictionary of Icons runs this way. One, a graphic symbol on a computer display screen represents an app, an object such as a file, or function such as the command to save. Yeah, save. B, a sign, such as a word or graphic symbol whose form suggests its meaning. Number two, an object of uncritical devotion, idol. Idol? Icons are not idols. Three, emblem, symbol. The house became an icon of 1960s residential architecture. You have to go all the way down to four to hear what I'm talking about. And five, a conventional religious image typically painted on a small wooden panel and used in the devotions of Eastern Christians. And five, a usual pictorial representation image. That's where I'm going to. Number four and number five on the icon, not the cartoon on your app. So what are the iconic images of the coronavirus? When terrorists strike, or when a natural disaster rushes up on us, there are images we remember, the photographs that we recognize, photos in the paper, on TV, and our minds wrap easily around them because we know them. Cops standing in the street near a body, the broken bits of a building, lumber in a yard, rubble, broken lumber, windows broken, a child's toy in the middle of it, a doll or a tricycle, or those posts of houses washed away by a hurricane against the sky. And when terrorists hit, they're usually smoke, people running, police lights, yellow tape. All this is familiar. We understand them. They speak to us of action defined, of cops hunting killers, or in the aftermath of a tornado or a hurricane. But up until now, the images associated with coronavirus are of three types. The really lack of image, the empty space of the great cities, or their graphs and charts representing numbers, or politicians and physicians holding briefings. And then there are people in masks, anonymous. It's the lack of a defining image that I think is difficult. It's hard enough to deal with what's happening with the deaths, because the death happening in hospitals is private. So private now that their loved ones can't even be near. And they're surrounded by mass strangers, not even a priest to hear their confession. We hear the numbers, we read the words, it's death in the abstract. But then I saw something in the news that I could put my brain around. It was a truck. It was a truck parked outside a hospital in New York, a refrigeration truck, the back doors of it open, its mouth open, waiting for the dead. Will this be the iconic image of the coronavirus? As we approach Easter, and as Christians are in the process of weighing our souls and scraping them down and preparing for the resurrection, I'd hope the iconic image of coronavirus would be helpful, uplifting, at least maybe a candle lit in the darkness, or an Easter lily, or somebody's front yard full of daffodils and winter crocuses pushing through the light. But I fear it's going to be trucks. They're sending refrigeration trucks to New York, and I'm sure they'll send them to Chicago. And if you were in Chicago during the heat wave of 1995, you saw trucks just like that one. The heat came so hard and so fast, the elderly alone had no chance. They were cleaned out. Old people, afraid to leave their homes because of crime, they kept their windows shut or they had them nailed shut, as poor people do in crime-ridden neighborhoods. Their homes became their ovens. Government didn't know how to respond. And the refrigeration trucks were full. As I'm talking to you, there are news reports of pastors being arrested for holding Christian services. That's troubling. They say they're following social distance rules, 6 feet apart in the pews. Journalists at news conferences sit 6 feet apart as the politicians and elected officials tell you all about their plans for fighting coronavirus. And this, the politicians talking, is considered essential, a public servant's. But is not worship essential? I'm not a theologian. I'm not an infectious disease specialist. I'm not a constitutional scholar. I see the need for people to stay in their homes. I love that video by Lori Lightfoot, Stay in Your Home. Save lives, stay in your home. It's all about love, ultimately. If you care about others, you don't even know. You don't want them infected either. But right now we're seeing the pushback, this friction between what human beings want and what government wants. And I don't know how to resolve it. Zeus was tugging on the leash. There were rabbits in the park and robins. But I tugged him back. And then we kept on walking in that light, misty rain. And in my earphones, another song came on. Leonard Cohen and the Sisters of Mercy. And I think that's what we need now. Mercy. And a few laughs, and patience, and kindness, and thinking about others, thinking about yourselves and the people you love.
Well, I've been where you're hanging, I think I can see how you're pinned. When you're not feeling holy, your loneliness says that you've sinned.
Hello, Chicago Way fans. Thanks for listening. As always, we really appreciate you guys tuning in every week and posting on Facebook and sharing with your friends. You can't do that enough. Trust me, it's such a weird time we're in. And as somebody who has to go to work every day, because technically I'm what's called a first reporter, so I'm an essential worker because we're on air and AM radio is a federally regulated entity. So my life hasn't changed quite so much in the fact that everything is, you know, I'm stuck at home or I don't get to do the things I normally do, because in reality, my job is pretty much the same, although everyone else on my team is stuck at home, so it makes my job a little bit harder and harder in the fact that I just have more to do to prepare them because they can't come in and to the station and get what they need. And yeah, you know, woe is me. It's not really. I'm actually quite lucky in that I still have a job and I still get to do what I do and I still get paid. And I, as someone who came from the restaurant industry, I completely understand what everybody's going through. I worked through the 08 recession and had to take a couple of tough hits, but luckily I was in a management position at that time and it worked out for me in the long run. But I really feel for those who are struggling, and I try every day on Ro Khan's show on WGN to at least highlight or offer suggestions and offer resources for those who are struggling, because it's a tough time and we're all in this together. And I really think that, you know, our country has been beaten down by tough things in the past, and we will certainly persevere and come out on top and be better than ever. And I just pray for everybody, and everybody who is struggling, know that, you know, there are others out there and that you're not alone. And by all means, reach out to John or myself on Facebook or Twitter, and, you know, give us your thoughts. If you're really depressed and you're beat up by this, shoot us a note and, you know, let us know, and we will put you in our prayers and put you in our thoughts and respond and let you know that you're not alone. There's plenty of people. And then more people than you can imagine who are struggling right now. And to those who don't think this is a serious problem and are still towing the line that this is a quote unquote hoax or a just a Democrat ploy to discredit the president, you know, pull your head out of your ass. This is beyond all of that. This is beyond everything. And I think the president's tenor and tone this week has really highlighted that this is unusual times and really dangerous. So let's be in this together and let's look for the silver linings and the bright spots to come. We need it and we'll get there. Just hang tough. And with that in mind, I do want to share some of the lighter things that John and I have been over the past few years on the Chicago Way. Some of the things that we think are really interesting and some of them that are make us proud. And one of those that I think is one of the best interviews I've ever heard John do. And I can't tell you how fun it was to just sit and listen to John do this next interview here, which is John talking with Carrie Nahabedian, who was the co-owner and executive chef of Brandeel, and still is, and is an award-winning chef who has an amazing, amazing pedigree and offers so many interesting insights into what it's like to be, especially a female chef in up until recently, a male-dominated industry. It's such a great, great interview, and it really shows John's passion. John, when we taped this, was so giddy and grinning from ear to ear talking to Chef Carrie, because he knows what she does and he appreciates how good she is and how studied she is with everything she does and everything she presents herself as, because it's genuine. She's really, really a unique person and presents the idea that you know, being a chef is more than just cooking eggs at the right temperature or braising a lamb with the right recipe. It's about an art and it's about an understanding of everything that's come before you. And so here it is, Michelin-starred Chef Carrie Nahabedian with John Cass on the Chicago Way.
Chef Carrie Nahabedian, did I do it right?
I believe so.
Who's one of the top chefs in Chicago. She's got Naha, the restaurant Naha, and another one I can't pronounce. It's a French one. She had an amazing meeting the other day in her restaurant with women chefs talking about what it's like to be a woman working in the kitchen world. You know, there's sexual harassment. There's people being treated badly. It was just a fascinating thing. I read it in the Tribune. And so we called Chef Carrie, and she said, yes, she'd do it.
Hi.
Hi.
Carrie.
Carrie, I'm so thrilled to talk to you. I can't believe it.
I'm so thrilled to talk to you. I'm a huge fan. Huge fan.
We're talking to Carrie Nahabedian. How do I pronounce that properly, Carrie?
You have it. You got it.
Because I know the Armenian Greek thing, okay? And I know what you grew up on. I know what you grew up eating. I know the taste sensations. Let me tell everybody before we begin, the two greatest culinary sins of my life. One, I was a famous chef asked me Trotter, Charlie Trotter, he asked if he could make beer can chicken for me, and I should come over and eat it. And I was too intimidated. The other was Carrie Nahabedian wanting to cook lamb with me on Easter one day. And I didn't do it because of the same thing. I'm a meat and potatoes guy, and to be with like cooks like of your stature, I'm just like a little tiny, like shrinking violet. I just
no, but on. You sit there and write an article about your onion soup all day long, and people are like, "Oh my god, he makes onion soup!"
Yeah, like big deal, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like for a real chef, you're like, "Yeah, really? Okay, what you put water on veal bones and you cooked them for 24 hours? Awesome!"
You know, like my mother always says to me, "You always credit me for teaching you everything you need you know, but I never cook like this." I said, "Yeah, but you provided the base. So a great lamb is a great lamb. You don't screw around with it. It's like a great turkey. You don't screw around with it. You just make it really good."
Now, how did you begin your cooking life? Because you have two restaurants, right? You have Naha and how do I say
Brandy.
It? Brandy.
Brandy. Brandy. Branch with a new growth in French. Brandy. A lot of people say brindle, and we don't correct them. We just let it go. It's what it is. Naha is in its 18th year, which is crazy.
Michelin star. James Beard Award winner, which is the Oscar of cooking. She has, I mean, I just wanted to throw that in. Sorry, Sherry.
Thank you. That's so nice of you. You know what? I started in high school. I was at Maine East in Park Ridge, and a pretty progressive program. And you had, I had a class where I needed to work in an environment where their food was being prepared. And I love cooking, and I was a student of learning about French cuisine, and I just absorbed everything that I could possibly find at 16 years old. And I should say my late father, my dad died last year, was a combat wounded World War II veteran from France, from Europe. And he was doing the carpet. He worked for Marshall Field at the Ritz-Carlton, and it was opening. So this is like 1975. And I'm in high school, and every day my father would come home and tell me about all the French chefs and the hotel was opening and all this grandeur and how he spoke to the chefs and that he was in Normandy and everything. And next, and I was like, "You have to get me a job. I have to work there. I couldn't." Every day when he would come home, I couldn't wait to hear about like the new silver and china. Because remember, the Ritz was like the first luxury hotel since the Drake. And so he went to the French chefs and talked to them in French because he spoke French after being in the war. And he told them that I have a daughter who's just crazy about cooking, and my wife's an exceptional cook, but my daughter has taken over the kitchen at 16 years old. And so there's no greater honor for a Frenchman than someone that save them. And they said, "Bring her in. Yeah, absolutely." And so he walked in one day with an application, and that's how it all started. And I had to wait till I was 17. But I was just telling a couple of my cooks the other day that in high school, I worked six nights a week. I was working 48 hours in high school. And I would take the bus down Dempster to the Skokie Swift to the L, walk from Chicago and State. And then every night at like 11 o'clock, my dad would pick me up. And as soon as I could get drive legally at night, my dad just threw me the car keys and said, "You know, I'm tired of picking you up every day at night." So that's how it all started. I started working at the Ritz-Carlton. And
who was the chef? Who was the French chef?
The chef was Danielle Viget, who was a very imposing, really atypical Frenchman, very imposing. And he left shortly thereafter. I think there was some form of something happened. And then Jacques Abadie came in, his assistant, who... and then my mentor worked for Jacques, Fernand Gutierrez, who was, if you looked at Fernand, you would have loved him, because if you looked at his picture and then in a dictionary, it would have said French chef, because his picture personified what a chef looked like. Heavy set, big mustache. He wore a toque so well. And he was my mentor, Sarah Stegner, George Bombaras, Susan Weaver. These are all chefs in Chicago that, and he mentored more chefs for Four Seasons hotels than any other person. He was, and very appropriately, he died on Bastille Day many years ago. But crazy man. And just every inch of him was about passion about cooking. And luckily for me, I met him when I was 17 years old. And we had, I saw him, a week before he passed away. And he, every step of my career, he was one of those guys that you could just pick up the phone. And he would never pick up the phone and call you. If you wanted something, you called him. And he, like Jean Bonchet and Jean-Claude Poulevet, and all, as we call them, the French Mafia here in Chicago, Jean-Joe Gabino, they really shaped my career because it was the real network. There was no Facebook. There was no Twitter. There was no social network. It was, we'd all hang out together. I was a young 17-year-old with all these amazing chefs that, I guess I was very fortunate that they recognized my talent, and that's how it all happened.
Did you have talent when you began, or did you, or was it something about your attention to detail and being prepared when they were ready to ask you a question in this? It's got to be incredibly frenetic, high pressure. Working in a kitchen. I mean, just think, if everyone listening, if you got 30 people for dinner, like, or 25 for Christmas dinner, and you're running around the kitchen, right? You're like, oh, and your uncle's like, what? Where's my whiskey and soda? And everybody's saying
exactly.
This and that, right? And you got, and you're taking care of that. Now imagine a huge restaurant where individual diners want perfect stuff, and you're a kid working in this restaurant with him, with these great chefs. Like, you were the first, I think the first woman to work for at Le Francais, right? No?
Right, to cook in the kitchen. But, I have to say, Bonchet, a lot of these, they admired women because I have to say, and I'm saying it in the most sincere way, behind almost every great French legendary chef, they all started in the kitchen that was started by their mother or their grandmother or by their restaurant. So they came up that way. It wasn't, generally speaking, it wasn't the father that was the chef. They all learned from their mother or grandmother. So I kind of piggybacked on that. And I think the biggest thing is that a lot of people felt that I was a natural, but I also was a student of the craft, that I really believed in it. And I bought every book that I could possibly read about the history of French cuisine, and I just kept reading up on it. And then I worked my way into the kitchen. I was 17 years old, like I said, and I think they just were so in awe of my determination and putting my head down, just coming in every single day, and I just didn't stop. I didn't stop asking questions. I didn't stop learning. And to this day, it's still my passion. And
you can hear it from your voice just talking about those days. You could hear it.
I get nervous when I interview people and they're like, I'll ask them, what were they doing the last year and a half? Because there'll be a big gap. And I tell people all the time, like, come up with a great story. Don't look at me and say, well, I got really burned out and I got scared and I stopped cooking. A lot of people go through it because it is an incredibly taxing profession. And you're on all the time. Like you just said, I'm in the kitchen and all these people want everything, but I have an incredible team. I can only do what I do because I have a great team in the restaurant. I have that great bartender up front who's making your uncle that cocktail. Whereas when I'm cooking family dinner, it's like I'm, you know, everyone's looking at me. So when are we going to eat? And I'll be making, I'll be cooking, I'll be plating up. I forgot what meal I was just doing. Maybe it was Christmas. Recently, I did Christmas, and I looked at my mother.
You're doing Christmas for the family, so okay, cousins and everybody, right?
Yeah.
All right.
And
so
I look at my, and I look at my mother. I'm like, how did you ever get every single dish out hot? That's always the trick. You're just jamming things into the oven in these beautiful dishes to get out to the table that everyone's just staring at you waiting. And she said, well, you were younger, so it always just looked like we were so organized, which is kind of true. Like when you're younger, everything looks so extravagant.
When you cook for the family, okay, there's like, I'm just trying to think of the whole ethnic thing. There's certain things like that. You know, certain ethnic restaurants, like Greek restaurants, they're kind of trapped in the 1950s. You know what I'm saying? We're trapped in our ethnic foods, right, from when we came over. And so I wonder, like, with the Armenian food, which is very similar, do they want it a certain way? Like, do they, like, they expect the lamb to be, you know, overly well done? Like, I won't cook beef for Greeks. I swear to God, I won't. I get very upset. You know what I mean? Like, no steaks for Greeks. No way. Not going to happen. Do you get that? You're like, no, it's a little pink. It's fine, Uncle.
Well, I'll
Uncle
tell
George.
Uncle George. How many Uncle Georges do you have, right? You know? My cousin Michael, who's half Greek, half Armenian, he had three. At one time he had three Aunt Helens. It was kind of crazy, right? It's like that scene in My Big Fat Greek Wedding, you know, Pete,
yeah, right.
Robert,
Pete,
Nick. Nikki. I'll tell you this. We say this all the time at Naha, that I'd rather cook for every Michelin inspector, food writer, critic, the most demanding customer, than to have a few Armenians in the dining room, because it's like when my mother and father would come and eat, I'd be like, okay, remember everyone, don't refill my mother's coffee, get her a fresh cup, make sure about this, make sure about this for my father, because you're on, like, this is your family. And so when I started making Lat Majun, and like our bar menu has a lot of Armenian specialties, Middle Eastern. We call it from our Greek Armenian heritage. We don't pigeonhole just Middle Eastern.
Right.
But there's still some Armenians that come in thinking that they're going to get, you know, shish kebab and rice pilaf, and they're so disillusioned. But I did put Lulu kebab lunch menu,
yeah.
And I had it on restaurant week last year at lunch. And so many people freaked out, like, oh, my God, it's so great. But then my Uncle George, my dad's brother, Michael's father, would come in. Oh, it's a little guzu, which is in Armenia, a little spicy. Then somebody else, my mother, would come in and go, you know, it could take a little more kick, Carrie. And, you know, like, everyone is critical. You're like, oh, the tabbouleh needs more parsley. This needs more mint. This, you know.
So I know. Don't they know who they're talking to? Like, if you, when you cook at home, when you're cooking, like, when you do, like, a lamb at home, okay, are they all telling you, like, when it's ready? Like, I don't need you to tell me, dude. I know when it's ready, you know?
Yeah, just make sure it's not raw. I love when they say, if they see any amount of, but I've, over the years, I feel it's my duty, every chef's duty, that if someone eats meat well done, it's our duty to slowly, and say you're a regular, so, like, I'm going to give you a bit of advice. Your uncle or someone in your family that eats well done, just go kind of lean it towards medium well. So there's just a little bit of life left in that meat, piece of meat. And then every time, push it just a little bit further. And before you know it, they're eating medium. And they don't even know it. Because at one point, the reason why they eat well done is because one time they got meat and they got a lot of blood and it freaked them out. So I always do that. I lean them little by little. I get them out that way. So now when I cook lamb, it's a solid medium, red medium, and no one even quibbles about it.
You know,
all they want to make sure is that the skin is crisp, lots of lemon, lots of garlic.
If, you know, one of my favorite programs is Chef's Table on Netflix. I know they get a little bit overdone, sometimes pretentious, but I would offer one if I were a producer. You, Carrie, bring a bus full of Armenians to like a sushi restaurant and tell them how to eat raw fish, because if you try to do that with Greeks or anybody out from our, they just freak. Okay, I have to ask you another thing.
Okay.
The reason why it's like a news event happened, but it was really an excuse just to talk to you, okay? But
okay.
The news event happened, which was the Tribune did a story on women. You had a meeting of some of the chefs, women chefs. I just call them chefs because I don't care what their sex is,
you know,
or their politics. I really don't. I care about the food. And they talked, and you did too, about harassment in the kitchens and the nature of being a woman in the kitchen. I was struck by, you know, I can understand any woman has been, guys don't understand how women get treated anywhere. We just don't. We think that everyone treats women the way we do, and you can't accept it in your mind what happens. But you were working for all these great traditional French chefs. How was it for you in that respect?
Well, as I mentioned, I listened to the ladies, and a few had very, very compelling stories. Beverly Kim, very compelling. And I, my mentor, Fernand, right out of the gate said to me, I want you to know, if you have any problems, you come to me, which I think right away, that set the tone. I was 17 years old. He went to every single person that I possibly would come in contact with and remind them that this girl's 17 years old and I can't say what he said, but don't fool around.
It had something to do with a boning knife, right? In his hand.
And I, you know what? I hate the whole thing about being, oh, she's a woman astronaut, or she's a woman chef, or she's a woman CEO, because right away you get tagged. It should be like the head of this company, the CEO happens to be a woman, that sort of thing. And I will constantly say that if you use your sex and say, oh, I can't do this, I can't lift this up, oh, you know, I can't kill the lobster, oh, it's, you know, I can't butcher the soft shell crabs. It's alive. And you get all girly and all baby on them. That's exactly how you're going to be treated. But if you go in there and you start doing what you're doing, and I'm, you know, I've had two back surgeries, so I've paid my dues. But if you go to lift up a pan of 75 pounds of veal bones and I can't do this. But if you say to your cook next to you, hey, can you help me get these in the oven? You're going to get a lot more respect because you're taking one side of the pan, he's taking one side. And little by little, the culture changed. And I'm not going to say that I didn't have everybody hitting on me going along. But I also, we had an enormous amount of work to do. So I would look at everyone and say, you know, we got a lot of work to do. I'm going to take your job. A lot of guys, I would say to them, listen, if you take your eye off the ball, I'm right there to take your saucier position. And I think that scared them more is that I had a lot of ambition, and I had a genuine ambition. I've never chased money, so it's never about that. It was just I always wanted to learn more and more and more and be the best that I could. And I worked in an environment where, yes, it was a very sexist kind of situation, but not in the way that people are talking about it now. I never was threatened. I was never harassed.
Not
I was never
Harvey
put
Weinstein
in the situation.
Thing. Right.
No, Harvey's. Never. Yeah. I think everyone just respected how I was and what I cooked. And I was very happy and lighthearted about it. And I know it could sound so superficial. And, you know, I talked 2 hours, 3 hours, we had this meeting. And of course, I'm reading the quotes of it. And I said, oh, God, I'm going to get blasted because everybody wants chefs that cook happy. But I'm going to say it to you because you're going to understand what I'm saying, is that you, if your lamb knows that if you're stressed or you're unhappy and you're in a pissed off mood, your lamb, you're not going to show any love to that lamb. And when you serve it, it's just, people are going to say, what's it missing? I'll tell you what it's missing. It's missing that passion, and it's missing that love that the cook is putting into that dish. They're going that extra step to baste the lamb. They're going that extra step to make sure those potatoes are crisp and everything. It's the same thing in a restaurant. If a cook is unhappy, it shows up in their food, and you know it immediately. If they're unhappy or they're stressed, a woman is cooking in the kitchen and she's harassed by a man, and she's just like, you know, I'm going to show him. And you know, little by little, she just goes through the motion. And before you know it, you got that situation where someone's burnt out and they leave the profession. And that's what's happening right now, is that, you know, I got asked by an ad agency the other day, and I told them they have to work harder at finding women to portray their ads for television. But the reason that women are leaving the profession is that it's really, really hard. It's a lot. It's an enormous amount of work. And then segregated to the amount of chefs that are married and then have children and who's been divorced and things like that. It's not easy, because your day's ending, or maybe not, but your day's ending at 5 o'clock. My second day is just starting. I work in the morning, and then I work all day, and then it's 5 o'clock, and then it's dinner. And, you know, I walked out the door last night. It was close to 1 o'clock in the morning.
What is your favorite time in the restaurant? Do you have a favorite time?
I really like just before dinner service starts. When I was a young cook, only once in my career did I work lunches. And that was at Le Perroquet. I worked lunch. But I never was one of those that liked working days. I liked the adrenaline, the buzz of dinner service, because, I mean, that means that you're on the top of your game. If you work dinner in a great restaurant, it's because that you are really tremendous. And I like that last minute, the candles being lit, the waiters, you know, firing their aprons, getting themselves ready, and sitting at the bar, because we do a pre-meal a half hour before service, and we go over every single person coming in. And I know it sounds so ordinary, but we talk, you know, it's that the calm before the storm.
There's nothing ordinary about it. It, as Jeff said, it's showtime, right, Jeff?
Yeah, absolutely, Chef.
It's showtime.
I was on the other side, in the service side, for a decade, and that was always my favorite piece, that calm, that getting ready to bring the curtain up on another service, and just that anticipation, that energy was always fun.
Both my older sisters, I'm the youngest, work at Naha, and they were never in this industry at all. But I went to them and said, Michael and I can't do what we need to do without you here. One was in finance and banking, and one was in the travel business. I said, I need you here, because I just need you here. I can't be worrying about, to this day, 18 years in, I don't even know the combination to the safe. And it's just one of those things that I'm glad I don't know, because it's one thing that I could wash my hands of, that I don't have to open the safe. But I can do what I do because I don't have to worry about the bookkeeper or the tips or things like that, that someone is there that I can trust. And the first thing my sister said after about a month, they were like, wow, this is so great. The day just flies by, because it's exciting. You know, owning a restaurant is very, very exciting. And they're like, you know, you come in and you're getting ready for lunch, and then it's lunch, and then there's family meal. Next thing you know, you guys are getting ready for dinner. And I go, yeah. And then you guys leave, and we start the whole thing all over again. And I think that is what people find, what the media finds so attractive about our industry, is that it makes it sound like all we do is have tons of fun. But at the end of the day, if a carrot needs to be peeled, that carrot needs to be peeled. And there's nothing more glamorous than
no,
that.
Leaks.
You know?
How about leaks? Just rinse the leaks, the sand out of the
rinse
leaks.
Rinse the leaks.
Right?
Like I say to some of my cooks in the kitchen sometimes, it's not all cupcakes and milkshakes. Like, every day isn't always pristine. But it takes just as long. I live by what people have taught me, and I will say it takes just as long to do it right as to do it wrong. So why bother doing it wrong? Because then you have the extra step.
If if people are listening to this, I have colleagues who say they would like to open up a restaurant. And I always say, you know, you don't know what the bleep you're talking about, okay? You have no idea what you're talking about. And I'm not even talking about the linen service guy or the bread guy. You know what I mean? I'm talking about, you know, just running a restaurant. You're crazy. It's hard. But if someone, if a young person listening to this, another Carrie, 17-year-old young woman, starts with Julia Child, right? Starts with the old recipes and tries to make them for her family. And I can see you doing that as a child. What advice would you give them on how to become or even begin the path? Because one thing kids don't really understand is they think that there's some kind of, like, it's a story, like life is a story with, like, say, an old Fat John Cass, you know, who gives you, and you come to the crossroads and I say, go to this road or this road. It's not like it's not that. There's no path. You have to make your own. But how would you begin to be a chef? How would you take that first step where I say, you know, I really love cooking and I would like to be a chef? Where do you go? What do you do?
Well, you take a few, you outlined it perfectly, because the biggest problem with our profession is that, like, when I was starting out, it wasn't necessarily really glamorous, and people would look upon it as it's just too hard, it's too difficult as a woman. Like, do you really want to do that, get all dirty? But my parents would see my enthusiasm every day when I would come home. And the minute I graduated high school, I moved. My sisters and I, my father had an apartment, and he let us, you know, we moved right downtown, and I never looked back. And I will say the same thing about a 17-year-old coming in, is that you have to be true about what you want to do. Our industry is the biggest industry in the, you know, biggest employer in the world. And there's so many paths that you can choose. Not everyone's going to take the path that I took, or the path that, like, Grant Atkins or Thomas Keller or Daniel Ballou. I mean, now you're taking my path and going even to a different, whole different level to create things that no one else has created before. Those are the half percenters, the quarter percenters there that have chosen something that, or their career chose them. But I would say the most difficult thing is getting to the point that you have to convince someone to open the door the first time for you, that you need someone to give you a chance. And more you need a mentor. Especially now, you need a mentor to say, let me help you, guide you with the career. Because I'm not going to say millennials. I'm just going to say people nowadays. When I was coming up, you stayed at a job for 2 years minimum. 2 years minimum. Now you have cooks that have four jobs in 2 years, and they still will get a job anywhere they go because it's the new norm. Oh, you know, I'm there for 6 months. But I tell my cooks all the time, treat me like a sponge, because I'm going to treat you like a sponge. You get everything out of me, and I'm getting everything out of you. So if you need something from me, if you want to learn, if you want to know how to make something that maybe we're not cooking that day, it's my duty as a chef. It's my job to guide them and say, okay, we don't have a roast leg of lamb on the menu, but you want to know how to do it? Okay, this is how you do a roast leg of lamb. Or yesterday I taught, you know, two cooks, at Bron D how to skin Dover soles, how to break down racks of lamb, how to break down Dorad. That took me, you know, maybe 30 minutes out of my day, but it enriched those two cooks more so than watching it on YouTube, or maybe they didn't even learn it in culinary school, because the culinary schools are stretched to the limit right now. So I remember coming home and telling my father that I wasn't going to culinary school, that I wasn't going to college. And he was like, every one of my kids is going to college. And I was like, I'm going to save you $50,000. I'm not going to go to the CIA. I'm learning more on the job. And that's the big thing right now, is that open the door for the 17-year-old for the first time. Open the door. And it's a lot of work to train somebody that has never been in a kitchen before. You have to sell everybody in the kitchen that, by the way, this person's coming in and we're going to teach them everything we know. And they give you a big sigh like, oh, my God, how long are they going to last? Like, they've never worked in a kitchen. But if they have that enthusiasm, they have the passion, and they're true to the craft. Fernand used to say all the time, you have to be true to the school. You have to be true to the base of cooking. And they're going to succeed. And know that you didn't become a columnist on page two your first year of being a journalist. You're not going to come out of culinary school or your first job and be a sous chef. There is no timeline like a doctor, like you go to pre-med and you go to school and you do internship and that sort of residency. There is no timeline. You'll find that people will take any job. If someone thinks you have talent and you could be the sous chef or the chef de cuisine, and you don't know how to spin ice cream and you don't know how to do pastry, you are overpromoted. And then at some point in your career, you're going to have to take a few steps back. So that's what I would say, is that you have to learn everything and don't go for the money right out of the gate. Just pay your dues, learn, learn, learn. And I know it sounds so old school, but it's really the truth. I'm amazed at how many people I come across and they don't know how to roast a chicken. Like, they don't know how to tie a chicken. Like, that's 101. That's basic stuff. And it's because someone didn't take the time. And I get nervous all the time that I tell my cooks, everything you do at your next job is a reflection on me and how well I trained you. So just be as passionate about it as how you want to be. This is your career. You're not doing this and becoming an actor, or you're not doing this while you're going to school. This is what you've chosen to do. So that's my words of advice.
I have interviewed many people, from politicians to gangsters and, you know, the usuals that you see in the column. I have never, mm-hmm. It's been a pleasure.
Thank Truly. You. Let's cook some lamb one day. Come over to Naha.
I'm going to come over. Okay? We'll talk. And
all right.
I'm not going to have you perform. I could just sit here and listen to you for hours, but we're running out of time, and I want to thank you so much for spending time with us.
I so appreciate it, and thank you for thinking of me, and I wish you nothing but more happiness.
Thanks, Carrie.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Chef Carrie.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.
I got to thank Carrie Nahabedian, my friend, and I love her story about how she started in the kitchens at the Ritz, something she loved, learning something she loved. And before she gets back from Florida, I'm going to have her, we'll hope to get her on the Chicago Way and have her talk about a couple of recipes, because I figure you guys are starving and you can't eat pizza puffs and frozen pizza all the time. You gotta cook some food, meat with vegetables, maybe a slow braise. So thanks to Carrie Nahabedian, and thanks to my friend Jeff Carlin.
executive producer of the Rokan Show on WGN, for his expert handling of the Wayback Machine and all the sound here. And I guess I got to thank me for me, John Kess. Thanks for listening. Thanks to you for listening. You can find us on Spotify, iTunes, or any of the platforms. Write us a kick-ass review on iTunes, and I might give you one of my secret recipes, spinach and rice, spanakorizo. So join us again next time for another edition of the Chicago Way on WGN+.